On this week's show, are materials and inventory management your next strategic advantage? With Maria Davidson from Kojo.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
Hey, Maria, how we doing?
We're doing very well. It's fun to be here. I've been a fan for a long time.
Well, it is great to have people on who've been watching and fans, and I've enjoyed the conversations ahead of time. Everybody listening in is gonna notice it's just Maria and I today. Sometimes these things happen, but the show must go on, and I think we're gonna have a great conversation, just the two of us. So with that, there's nothing for us to worry about other than let's get into learning more about Maria. So tell me a little bit about your backstory. How did you get into construction tech and where you are now?
It's a great question because I started off, I studied politics, philosophy, and economics at Oxford. I'm from London originally. I had very little to do with construction in the US when I got started, but I actually moved to San Francisco back in 2016 to help set up a venture capital fund. And moving to San Francisco, I remember I was really, really shocked by how long it took to build just about any project. I remember walking around the city wondering how it was possible that the Van Ness bus lane by then had been being built for 15 years, I think, and still wasn't completed. I saw, it took 2 years to fix some potholes. I lived across the street from a BART station that was getting built that was years into the making and still hadn't actually started building above ground. And I just started getting really, really obsessed with the built environment. And as part of living in San Francisco, where obviously housing is a big topic, there's a real dearth of affordable housing. I started getting really involved in going to various YIMBY meetups and trying to think about how could we make construction faster? How could we make it more efficient? How could we make it more sustainable? And as part of that, I also started to talk to a lot of construction tech companies, which back then, if you remember 2015, 2016, it was sort of the first wave of construction tech. And what I heard is that every company that I spoke to was focused on the labor side and very heavily focused on the GC companies. And what I started to ask myself is, well, what about the trades? When you think about a commercial electrical company or a commercial mechanical company, how can we make it easier for them to do their jobs? How could we make it easier for them to get everything built? And it got to 2018 where I convinced a friend of mine to quit our jobs. And we said, we're going to go and we're just going to speak to as many people who work in the trades as we can. And we're going to understand what problems still exist for them, right? What are the biggest problems that they have? Because we had a very strong thesis that materials is 40% of the entire cost of building a project. And at that time, that was mostly managed with spreadsheets and phone calls and emails and, in some cases, much older software. And we went out, we started bringing donut boxes and pizza boxes around San Francisco job sites around lunchtime. We got as many people to talk to us as we could. We did this, 7 days a week for 6 months. I think we had thousands of conversations. We would just show up at trade shows with no booth and roam around and try to get as many conversations as we could going. And time and time again, what we heard was that materials were, in fact, 40% of a project's total cost. And they really impacted the delays that can happen, the time in the field that the field has to actually focus on installation versus on finding out where their materials are. And that's how we realized that, wait, if we could actually make managing materials, warehouse, inventory, tools so much more efficient, we could make a really big difference to how projects get built.
I like that story. And I want to go back and break it down a little bit. So looking at this from a venture lens, like going after the trades was not where most of the venture funds were going either. I am interested in, and we know some of the reasons for that, right? GCs are, you know, there's less differences amongst the way GCs work. Yeah, they work in the verticals differently than other verticals, but they're pretty similar. There's so much variety mm-hmm. when it comes to trade. So how did you even land on or have the, you know, like your financial mind had to be like, no, no, no. And, but something else was drawing you. So what drew you in to the trades themselves? I mean, other than being an underserved market.
Yeah. I mean, back in 2018, when we got started, I remember people thought we were crazy building specifically for the trades. I remember so many investors told us, you're going to have a sales cycle that's 5 years long. The trades don't want to adopt technology. Why are you even trying to do this? I mean, we really had so many investors in the really early days think we were completely crazy for trying to do this, because everyone was really used to selling to the GC market. And the GC market was widely acknowledged as the market that if you wanted to build construction tech, you should be building construction tech for. For us, I mean, the first piece was that it really was a very underserved market. But also, you know, as we started speaking to more and more companies in the trades, we realized these are companies that are really central to their local communities, right? Trades are very specific in terms of usually being very geographically focused. These companies work on projects that are hugely impactful to where it is that they live. And most importantly, right, it's the trades that are actually out there doing the installation. The foremen are out there in the field, literally getting the building built. And to us, we thought, wait, the trades are imperative, right? The trades are really what makes a building get built in the first place. And so the fact that the tech industry had in many ways ignored the trades for decades to us seemed really crazy.
I fully agree with you. And my initial experience leaving the trades being, I wouldn't say I was fully trade focused, but even my days, you know, I came from a trade. So I came from a mason. So obviously that's, I was jaded that way. And that's where I started. But I saw the same thing. And I also saw, and I'm interested, there's a couple things about that that I think venture got wrong, and I don't know why they got it wrong. One, I consistently, and kind of still hear, like, oh, the trades are not open to adopt. Mm-hmm. I fully disagree with that. 100% disagree with it.
But me where too. Does I that think come from? That's a myth from? That's been perpetuated for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain ones I do understand. Like, there are certain ones that are I don't want to call them less tech, but yeah, still, if you're a framer in and you're just building, you know, houses. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. You know, like, there's not a ton, but there's still plenty. You know, plans are still digital. Those things are still digital. So I'm wondering, as you've grown the company, as you've actually created a product, which we'll get into what you've created, is that myth lining up with fact, or are you finding something different?
No, I mean, for us, I think it's a myth that really needs to be debunked. And, you know, we're here to debunk it. We've now been operating for more than 6.5 years, and we work with more than 500 companies in the trades all across the US. But I think the reason that that myth exists in part is that a lot of the trades, right, number one, they're trade specific. So when we got started, we said, well, if you try to build for everyone, that's not going to work. You've got to be really focused and build something that's truly best in class for just one trade to start. But number two is that I think for a lot of the venture market, right, what's not clear is how to even get in touch with the trades in the first place. Because in many cases, right, the trades, they're not as online as people buying, let's say, marketing software or sales CRM, mm-hmm. right? And the traditional advertising methods of spending huge amounts of money on social media don't really work for the commercial trades. And so I think one of the things that for us, we focused on very, very heavily in the early days and still do today, is how do we come to where our customers are? right? How do we have a really strong field presence? How do we make sure that we're not just at the big annual events, but we're constantly doing events with local trade chapters and making it so that we are spending time directly with our customers? And that's quite antithetical to the usual venture model, right? Where traditionally you're looking for product-led growth companies that ideally, you know, are self-serve, or if they can be self-serve, that's obviously a huge advantage. You're looking for companies that can be found online very easily and interacted with online really easily. And the trades, you know, then just not that. And I remember even earlier in my career, you know, I used to do real estate investment banking at Goldman Sachs. And I remember we'd work with a lot of the large developers, and in talking to them, again, constantly it would come down to, well, the trades are who dictates if a building gets built on time or not. Because if any trade is delayed, that has a huge cascading effect on all subsequent trades. And I think that that, again, is often misunderstood, the extent to which the trades are there driving the project.
Oh, you hit on a number of things there that I think you're absolutely right. Like, one, I'm going to hit on this one, patience. Patience and meeting your customers where they are. I think you can make a quick splash in GC world. You can get quick adoptions. You can get some of those big logos we see on almost every software.
Yeah, and also, you know, on banners. I mean, GCs are much more visible. You walk around San Francisco, you see these giant banners out there. There are these big names that are synonymous with the construction industry.
But they're not actually the ones that are synonymous with getting the work done or getting it progressed or being at the crux of it. And it does take, because it's so different, you can't just build one. You've, like you said, you got to be a best in class. You got to pick a lane. You got to stay with it. We all know this. Venture and startup folks are not as focused and patient as we would like. And it takes focus and it takes patience to grow into the trades market. But like you said, the funny thing is the developers know. At the end of the day, it's if my electrical has their switchgear, if my, you know, I didn't even know this one. It's if my painters have the right coating for my HVAC or for any piping that's going into a water treatment plant. Like, it has to be there. It has to be done. It has to be delivered, and it has to be in sequence. This is not easy. Like, I love it. You do 4D modeling and you're like, you got to do this. You got to do this. You got to do this. And I'm like, well, you guys are forgetting. Like, if the materials aren't there, I don't care what your sequence says.
Yeah,
you can't do it.
If the materials aren't there, but the team is there, right? They can't make progress. And that really starts to add up. I mean, we have, you know, some of the biggest developers in the country are our investors, groups like Tishman Speyer and RXR and LaFrac, you know, groups like Suffolk Construction are also our investors. And we've spoken to all of them at length about, you know, how can we make it so that projects stay on time and get delivered on time? Because ultimately, when we think about the sort of cities we want to live in, right, we want to live in cities that are fast to build and where whenever we estimate something, we know we can actually hit it versus, you know, I think what you've seen in a lot of parts of the country, especially for these large scale projects, is, you know, a project that starts off costing $2 billion ends up costing $10 billion and taking three times as long to get built.
I mean, I've watched it in the estimating cycle go from $2.5 billion to $3.5 billion just because of material escalation over a certain period of time on a certain set of projects and products, because, you know, everybody's building data centers right now. There's not one or the other. Everyone's building. If you're in the EV world, you're building a battery plant right now. If you're a chip manufacturer with the IIJA, you're coming into the US to build advanced manufacturing. That's driving everything. And it comes down to the trades. One more thing, and this is a little nerdy and maybe just for my other founders like you that are listening, but that sales cycle, I think it's also a myth. And I'll be interested to get your feedback on how you felt about it. Just thinking, you just said 500 companies in 6.5 years. So if you look at that venture cycle you talked about, did you meet all 500 of them 5 years ago to get them on, or 6 years ago, like a half, 6 months after you baked the product.
No. And for us, by the way, it took us about 2 years just to build the product, because our product is very integration heavy. And these integrations took a long time to build in the early days. So we brought our product to market 4 years ago. So that's 500 customers in 4 years. And, you know, I think that's another myth. When you think about sales cycles are ultimately a function of the value that the customer sees and the ROI that you can clearly explain and crucially quantify. And so, yeah, it's true. You know, not that many commercial trade contractors are finding solutions online, downloading them and installing them themselves, that they expect to be solutions that are used enterprise-wide and that are going to be something that is going to become a critical part of a foreman or an accounting manager or a purchasing agent's day. But what we found is that if you can make sure that the ROI is really clear, everyone understands what's in it for them and why using this piece of software is actually going to make their day easier and remove a lot of the least pleasant parts of their day, then your sales cycle, I mean, you're actually talking a pretty fast sales cycle, mm-hmm. especially because, you know, for a lot of companies in construction, I think they've been waiting and wanting to drive operational improvements for a really long time. And especially today, you know, where you have a third of the construction workforce retiring in the next 5 years, you have a lot of companies changing ownership, whether it's, you know, you have the next generation is inheriting the company, whether the company is becoming employee owned, whether some employees are buying out the original ownership, whether companies are getting bought out, and, you know, whether that's by larger companies or whether that's by private equity. We see all flavors of that. And that, I think, has also driven a very big transition in companies saying, well, maybe I operated the same way or with very similar processes for the last 30 years, but now I have new people coming into the trades. And a lot of those people, right, they grew up with Amazon. And they grew up with the simplicity of doing things on their phone. And I think that is also driving much faster adoption than, you know, 10 years ago would have been the case.
Everyone supports a culture of well-being in the field and is equipped with the tools to help prevent suicide in construction. Procore Safety Qualified courses were built in partnership with our customers, elevating enhancements to their standard OSHA training. And the Bringing the Right Mindset series equips individuals and leaders alike with the skills necessary to really build resilient teams. We've made these three courses available for free and on demand, and they're offered both in English as well as Spanish, and they are CEU certifiable. Procore.com/certified-qualified is where we host our Procore's learning portal, and anyone can use their Procore credentials or create a free account to get started.
And I think you hit on it. I'm going to go all the way back to it took you 2 years to build it because it's integration heavy. That is something people don't really give the trades so much of a credit for that I think I've noticed as they move to prefab, as they move to offsite, as they move to solve the problems that exist today because of that workforce change. And look, the workforce is diminishing and it's not going to... It can get better. It's never going to get where we used to be. It's just not going to happen. So they've had to think about integrated workflows from a building perspective. So I also think that makes them a little bit more apt to look for integrated products, products that fit inside of their system. Like GCs can afford to do and have 8 point solutions for someone that's working because honestly, they're managing work, right? It doesn't diminish their importance. It doesn't diminish their perspectives or what they do. But because what they do is technological, it's also management, right? You're making sure the trades are where they're supposed to be. You're making sure that, you know, design changes are there, et cetera. You're orchestrating it. Mm-hmm. It's a little different. They can have a little less of an integrated system and be in and out. When you're talking about, you know, fabrication, when you're talking about, you know, really connecting the back office to the installation of a product, trades have to think that way. And I know a number of companies are like, oh, we'll get to that integration. And it's also like, hey, we heard that before.
Yeah.
We were burned by that before. And we have that tool sitting over the in the corner and we don't use it. So I think they're much more critical because of the criticality of the entire workflow for them.
Yeah. I mean, integrations are so, so key. I think it's probably every contractor's worst nightmare to have 20 different point solutions, none of which exactly integrate with their accounting system or with each other, all of which have data that's siloed, right? That's no better than a world where you are managing everything on email and text message and phone call. It's digital, but you've just created a faster horse, right? You haven't actually led to a step change in operational improvement.
I love that. Point solutions are your faster horse.
No, they are, right? Because what you're thinking through as a company is, how do I get all of my data in one place that is very queryable, that is accessible to everyone I need to have access to it, and where we can constantly make better decisions and operate more effectively because now everyone is operating under the same set of consistent base truth, and all actions are getting fed into that same central repository. And for us from the very beginning, we realized that that repository, that's your ERP system, right? Every company in the trades at a commercial scale will have an ERP system, and that ERP system needs to be up to date. And you could build the world's best purchasing system, the world's best field app tracking system, but if it doesn't have a really first-class integration into that ERP, it's not going to actually solve the operational improvements that you're looking to bring in.
Yep. 100%. I fully agree with you. And understanding the art of what needs to be integrated in order to get that ERP system running at its optimal, there's a misunderstanding that like everything has to flow. It doesn't all have to flow. Mm-hmm. And in fact, what's critical about it is, and I'm going to plug something I did recently and I want people to read, is we're doing a monthly newsletter here at the crew. And yes, I am writing it. This is not an AI, guys, just so you know. But I had this idea of, it's not about single data sources, but connected data sources and fewer of them, right? Because then you need a lot of that data in the ERP system to make decisions, like you said, to inform what you're doing, to move things forward, get pay apps, do things like that. So that data should flow. Later on, when you want to do bigger data analysis, you need a couple of pools to pull from to create a lake, and you can go from there. If you have 11 of those different or 18 of those different point solutions and you try to pull that data later on, even if you're getting it some of it where you want, it's just going to be too hard. So if you had 3, 4, 5 systems, maybe I'd say 4, now you can do something. And you don't want that to be the thing that keeps people from moving in step.
Yeah, well, also any time that you have data that has to move from one system into the next, you create risk. And as someone who thinks a lot about risk management, which, I mean, every construction company does, you don't want to have tens of those exchange moments. You would much rather have it in all-in-one platforms where, you have 3 or 4 of them. You don't want to have 15 of them.
Yeah, 3 or 4 is about right, because, to be a robust enough system to handle what we need in certain respects, ERPs being one of them. I'd say project management, I think you can have both in one, but one does not exist that does that for construction at a level like a Procore, et cetera, does. It's just, it doesn't exist yet. If it existed, maybe we'd have a bit of a different conversation. But also, like, modern HR systems are so different than construction accounting systems. And construction accounting systems are what they are because construction accounting is unique. It hasn't changed in a long time, but it's unique.
Oh, so, it is, yeah.
Again, it's like modernize what you can, connect what you need to. But I love that idea of risk and understanding that every sink is a risk. I also think every time, you said this, a foreman, a superintendent, project manager, or an accounting and accounts receivable person leaves their system of choice to move to another system for some reason, there's friction.
Yeah, change management is hard. I mean, people get very used to doing things in a certain way. And I think to get people to change to a different system, it needs to be really, really clear what's in it for them to start with. And, you know, going back to the venture model for us, for the first 2 years, we were just building integrations. And a lot of investors were like, what's happening here? And we were like, well, listen, guys, like, we have to be a company that invests very heavily into R&D and that invests very heavily into R&D upfront. Because the way we think about it is we're not building a point solution, we're building a platform, right? We're building an all-in-one platform that can connect the field and the office and the warehouse and the AP team and all of the different teams that you need across the company all into one place. But yeah, Jeff, you're exactly right. And, you know, something we always say is you can build the world's best piece of software, but if you don't have a very good implementation team, if you're not thoughtful about how you drive tech transformation in partnership with the companies that you're working with, it's just not going to work. Because for a lot of people, they might say, listen, it's an inefficient system that I used to have, but am I really going to go and gather up everyone at the company and set this new vision and get everyone to come on this journey with me? That requires a lot of resources and it requires a lot of support and experience and technical know-how.
And a lot of political capital, and you only get so much. And if it's another point solution that then strands data or creates a need to do other things or doesn't solve that 80% like it's supposed to, back to your, and this is what I loved, I've heard a number of different ways for people to go out and do industry surveys. I've never heard of the donuts and pizza. The closest thing I ever heard was I had Damon Hernandez on, and he does it just for himself. He'll just like walk up to a job site and be like, hey, can I get 5 minutes for $5 and ask people questions? But I've never heard of the donuts and pizza thing. I think it's a great way to find problems.
Yeah, because you're just trying to get a conversation started, right? And, yeah. and you want there to be some reciprocity to that conversation.
Yes. And I mean, honestly, it's kind of like instruction therapy, but you're finding the commonality and the problem in listening. And now you've built, and again, this is what so often we don't see, is 2 years of stalwart patience focused on a problem, beginning with the end in mind. How many people are like, well, I need the minimum viable product, so I'm going to build the UI UX and what I'm going to do. And it's like, no, actually, begin with the end in mind means begin with those integrations, build something in the end that solves a problem, but fits it, and have the patience to get to that point. Because also now, I mean, I'm thinking about that 2 years to get out of it. That means 4 years for 500. That's really fast, right? And that's the old go slow to go fast.
Well, and you know, that's actually a big difference back to the venture conversation between GCs and trades, in that for GCs, especially for the larger GCs, they'll often have innovation departments, right? They'll have directors of innovation. They'll have entire teams that are dedicated to technology transition. And in many cases, right, they've built playbooks. They've done this many times before. They've done this at scale. I think if you're talking about a, let's say, electrical or mechanical contractor that maybe does $15 million worth of work a year, you know, they don't have a director of innovation. And that's where you have to be really, really clear about what value is going to be there for them. And my strong belief is that you can never speak to your customers enough, right? The best tech solutions are solutions that are driven by the user base. And you should never sit in a dark room saying, oh, I have all these grand ideas, I'm going to build them. And then when I build them, then people will understand this is what's been missing from the industry for a long time. You've got to speak to your customers and crucially iterate alongside them, right? Bring designs, bring mockups. At this point, you know, bring everything into a beta and have that beta be something that you really internalize customer feedback on. Because that's what's going to, you know, that's what allowed us to grow quickly.
being fanatical about those customers, being fanatical about their journey. But also, I mean, and you get this, like change management is something most people just, it just goes to the wayside. They just forget, and they forget on both sides, and they really do. But also one of the other pieces of the puzzle is she sees a $250 million GC might have as many people as a $30 million trade. So the scales are so different that we don't take that into account. A lot of solutions just don't take that into account. So, well, we can go over all of that for hours because I love it. But now we got to know, like, so you landed on a problem.
Yeah.
It's materials are 40% of cost, but what were we doing wrong? What was the real core crux problem that needed to be solved? And we can get into kind of how you guys have approached solving it.
Well, the problem was really threefold in that the first problem was how do we make the field more efficient, right? Because today your average field foreman is spending around 8 hours a month dealing with tasks related to materials management. And in some cases, that's more like 20 hours a month in cases where you're ordering a lot and orders are coming in on a every day or every other day basis. And all of that, right, is time that they could be spending doing installation work and not walking around trying to figure out where the materials are or ordering those materials or playing phone tag with the purchasing agent, clarifying has something been ordered or what are the exact specs of what needs to be ordered. Problem number two is that the office had to spend a lot of time doing manual data entry because all the orders from the field would come in different formats, right? Some would come in text messages, some would come in emails. Sometimes, you know, we saw cases where people would just take a picture of something and send it over and say, I need this for tomorrow. And the office was spending huge amounts of time just keeping up with processing all those orders, creating all those POs, inputting that into the accounting system. You know, an average PO we found cost $68 from beginning to end just to process. And for some of the companies we work with, they do 1,000 POs a year. Some of them will do 20, 30, 40,000 POs a year. And when you multiply that by $68, you're talking about hundreds of thousands. In some cases, you're talking about millions of dollars a year just in the cost of processing those POs. And you know, I was at a conference recently where one of our customers told us that on average, they were spending 12 emails back and forth with one of their distributors to confirm an order, right? And that, again, it takes up a huge amount of time to just stay on top of all of this. And the third problem also really came down to making sure you're always getting the best price, that you're quoting at the beginning of a project as much as you can, that you're tracking against that original bill of material to see how you're doing compared to how you thought you would be doing, and just having that level of transparency and oversight into the project. Because what we saw is a lot of companies told us, hey, our problem was that we're halfway through a project and we don't know how we're doing, right? We don't know whether we're even going to be profitable on this project because we don't have a tracking system where we can say, how are we doing compared to the estimate? But also to make sure that across all of the different projects we're running, we're buying the same materials at the same price and that our invoices are always matching up what we ordered and what actually got delivered. And, you know, that was the underlying set of problems we saw. And the more that we started diving in, the more we realized, all right, well, there's a lot of overordering in our industry, right? There's a lot of waste. And a lot of the time, the overordered materials, they get put in a warehouse. And then a problem that we realized was really pervasive is how do you make sure that the field knows what's in the warehouse and is ordering the materials that are already in the warehouse and not just going back and ordering everything anew from the vendor each single time. Same thing with tools. Yesterday, I was on a call with a customer that told me they think they had $1 million worth of tool inventory that they couldn't account for in any given year because tools would get checked in and out of jobs. You wouldn't have a system to know which tool was, you know, in maintenance or which tool was on a particular job. And that, again, right, these tools are really expensive. And so the overarching problem was that all of these various pieces of material or these tools, they were all managed in very disparate ways. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't one place where you could click into and say, all right, what have we already ordered? What's coming when? Where are all my tools? What's my warehouse utilization looking like? So that this process could actually be run more efficiently.
Okay, so you hit on a ton in there.
I speak fast, I know. So
that's okay. I think there's a ton of trades contractors that are listening that are going, yes, I have that problem. Yes, I have that problem. Yes, I have that problem. And GCs that need to see, oh, this is the things that our trades are dealing with. I absolutely love the inventory and knowing what's in your warehouse versus knowing what you have and the tools themselves. We did some research at one point and we found out that most of the tool hoarding that, by the way, because that's you're talking about people who check in and check out and they don't know where they are or they, you know, they don't have an inventory system. I'm talking about the ones who are like, no, whenever I need that, I can never find it. So mm-hmm. I'm going to keep it. And so I have it in a box that you'll never know about. And we had these guys who would just they'd be like, oh, yeah, here's where all those special tools are. And when I need them, I need them. So, but also you're talking about three different things, right? Materials distribution and tools and then managing and where you are on the project. Mm-hmm. But they all follow similar workflows. They're all based on the similar numbers. They're all based on progress. So it's like, mm-hmm. how many materials, you know, where am I on my material costs versus where am I on my installation, my percent to complete? These are things I need to, and these are things I need to know. And as an organization, I need to know each on the project level, but I also need to know them wider on the company level. Right. As cost of projects go up, materials go up, centralized or at least centralized people get really upset about because they want some autonomy depending on where they are. So talk to me about that, because I hear this idea of centralized purchasing versus distributed purchasing. Are you guys looking at that differently or are you finding a way to kind of make those two things possible?
Yeah, well, across a customer base of 500 different contracting companies, we see all different types of purchasing, right? We have some companies where the foreman order directly from the field, directly from the app, and that goes to a distributor. We have some cases where there are permissions, right? Where for different dollar values, you might need a project manager to sign off. Most commonly, we'll see that there is centralized purchasing where everything flows through a purchasing team. And for us, the goal was, how do we make the product as flexible and extensible so it could serve all of these use cases? The important thing is, whatever use case is right for your company, number one, it's understanding that it's not one size fits all, right? There are real reasons why a different pattern might work for one company and not work for another one. And it might be tied to the type of job that they're doing, to where they are, right? Are they in a urban, busy city center where deliveries are very difficult to manage and there's no warehouse storage? Or are they maybe building a solar plant far out in a place where storage is much cheaper? Mm-hmm. So we built the system to be very flexible around that. But I think the underlying challenge was, how do you make it so that the part that the field orders, well, by the way, the field will often use slang, right? That you're not going to write out the full two-line description every single time exactly correctly. Sometimes you're just going to want to say, I want a blue smurf, and you want the system to know what that means. So that's why we built in a lot of slang to make that easy. But you need to make sure that that description from the field is then very quickly and easily transmitted through to purchasing, through to the vendor, and that everyone is on the same page about exactly what's meant. And that for us was a lot of the data architecture work that we had to do, was actually cleaning that up. And I think right now, you know, AI has been a hugely transformative set of capabilities that are now possible in terms of doing that cleanup work, because now we can actually make it so that it's also easier for the vendor to do data entry, right? Previously, mm-hmm. sometimes vendors would get, you know, screenshots or photos sent to them, and then they would have to do manual data entry into their system. So the easier we make it for them to understand what the contractor is asking for, the faster that they can process that transaction on their end. And, you know, the lower the likelihood that something shows up erroneously. you know, I was talking to a customer recently that told me they had about $10,000 on average of waste on a project. They did 15 projects a year. So we're talking and I'm like, wait, that's $150,000 of waste. And they said, yeah, because for them previously, the problem was that the field was all placing orders directly with the vendor and one foreman wouldn't know what another one might have already ordered just earlier that day or yesterday. And so duplicative materials would show up. And the problem was actually a problem of over-ordering. And so that's where we worked with them to say, how do we set up your warehouse efficiently so that now when the field goes to order a material, you can route it to come from the warehouse instead of always being ordered anew.
Yep. And it's it creating the supply chain. And we've seen under-order, over-order, and you mentioned it, the number of times that anybody has to manually enter information is a high opportunity for risk. It's a lot of risk because people make mistakes. Those pictures, that slang, it's really hard to get it all right. And it's not that they don't want to get it right. It's just that by nature, we're error prone. So we're going to make these mistakes along the way. So this is where, you know, an integrated system is going to really solve a lot of those problems and help you, I bet, expose a lot of that. I'm sure that $10,000 of waste per, at some point they figured it out, but I bet you there's more that they find as they create transparency to what's happening already. As your warehouse starts to see what's flowing through. But then also, we were just talking about it. I mean, you have these $2.5, $3 billion projects right now. There is two things that can really cause a problem with. It can cause a problem with availability of equipment, you know, whatever it might be, materials in general. But it creates an opportunity for buying at scale, driving down cost, and increasing the availability and the predictability for the manufacturers themselves, right? Here's Lonnie Compton, who's at AEC Inspire, when he was with us on stage, he was like, listen, we cut our hangar costs by $300,000 because we were able to tell the manufacturer how much we needed when per quarter. By quarter, and they were able to say, okay, well, we can give you this discount for buying. And all that took was standardizing the hangar, using the models to predict what they needed, and then sending it out to the manufacturer. So you're not only taking $150,000 in savings, add $300,000 in overall material, you're saving close to half a billion dollars for a major contractor in material price if you do it right.
I mean, something else that I think is really, really important for contractors is just to have that data at their fingertips, right? A lot of the companies we work with, they'll negotiate pricing in advance with their vendors, right? Maybe they'll have an annual pricing agreement or they'll have some sort of master purchasing agreement. But being able to have all of that data about what was the per line item breakdown across different materials that you ordered, across different projects. In some cases, if you work across different geographies, again, right, you want to be able to go to your vendors and say, hey, this is an accurate picture of what my ordering looks like today. I know that next year, you know, our industry's seeing a lot of growth. We're going to be doing more work. How do we negotiate in advance better pricing? And that way you're having truly a transparent conversation that's anchored in data. And, you know, sometimes we've spoken to companies who they're very hesitant to even grow because they're saying, well, I don't want my margins to erode, right? I don't want to take on more work, but have that work become less profitable because all of a sudden I need to have way more people in the office processing all of these orders. I'm going to create a huge bottleneck for my accounting team. Like, people are very mindful that at the end of the day, your profit dollars are what drives the business.
Yep. And it's so true, because if you grow in a manual process, all you're doing is increasing your risk and just asking to have your margins eroded. Versus if you grow with scalable solutions that can augment the people, make them more informed by data and have more visibility. Here's another one too, is like, at some point you need that data to look back over and go, what was I ordering? Mm-hmm. And where are there opportunities for me to streamline what I'm doing? Hey, I'm ordering these different parts and I'm getting it from this vendor and that vendor, or from this manufacturer or that manufacturer. Is there a tweak I can make to, again, get more efficient and sit down at the table and talk to that that manufacturer, that distributor about what your plans are and get really, really prepared? By the way, the way to get in front of your competition, and there, let's just be honest, we're driven by competition, mm-hmm. is to know ahead of time, to get out ahead. And even sometimes I heard this, and this is a Trent Leinenbach, like, if I would pay 10, he said at one point on the Doorcast, he would pay 10% over cost to get 100% of the material when it was supposed to arrive, because 80% of the material is like none of it ever showed up. So there was actually contractors who would pay more just to make sure they had the materials to install.
Yeah. Oh, I think that, you know, to us, the way we think about it is data and technology only makes the relationship with your vendors even more important, because what now you can do is you can come in and you can actually say, hey, this is how often, you know, deliveries arrived complete. This is how often we had an issue with the delivery. And then you both can have access to the full set of information at hand and actually have a really informed conversation. Also at that stage, you can say, hey, if I know that only so many of my orders arrived complete, you can actually do what, Jeff, you're describing, right? You can say, hey, I'm actually willing to even pay a premium in order to have a different level of service, or I'm willing to pay a premium for different things that I might not have known my business needed, because it's actually going to drive operational efficiency. And so I think that to have an informed conversation like that, it actually only makes that relationship with your vendor stronger, because then they are able to actually offer a better level of customer service, and you're able to track that level of customer service, because now you can see it actually being reflected in the numbers.
Yep. You can measure it. You can manage it. I mean, that's the beauty of it. And it's as simple as that. And I mean, it's such a large cost and it's so variable, because, you know, we keep seeing this. We keep seeing supply chain issues. We keep seeing manufacturing issues. These things aren't going to go away, I don't think, ever. I mean, they might get better in 5-10 years as we bring advanced manufacturing back into the United States. We'll shore up the supply chain a bit. But there's always volatility. There's always raw material issues. There's always storms, accidents, wars. Now we know there's pandemics. Like, these things happen. So again, it's being fortified with data and information to sort of manage your business. Because that's the other thing. I was just having this conversation, and it was on a recent episode with Alexis McGuffin. A problem that's communicated early enough is just a decision. It's mm-hmm. not a problem. So if I can tell the GC, hey, those materials that you're asking for are way back ordered because every architect on the planet is speccing them right now. Here is some alternatives that we can bring that, you know, hey, the cost might be the same, but the predictability around and availability of the product is higher. Wow, now you're a strategic advantage, not just to your distributor, but to your actual customer, the owner or the GC, depending on how you're structured.
Yeah, and materials today are still 40% more expensive than they were in February 2020. Because to your point, Jeffrey, you know, I saw an article that brought up how many times the words manufacturing reshoring have been brought up in Fortune 500 earnings calls. And it was astounding. I think it was, you know, the year over year change of how many times those words get said is truly exponential growth. But it's going to take time to reshore all manufacturing. And more so if you're building data centers, right? If you're building anything, in fact, that requires switchgear or, you know, items that I was at NAED last week, you know, are frequently 52 weeks out.
Oh, yeah.
The more upfront you can communicate about that, yeah, you're right. Right, the relationship with your GC or with the developer that you're working with is also going to strengthen, because you're communicating up front, and you're able to, again, make sure that you're going to deliver much more accurately because your estimates are much more accurate.
Yep. And your decision-making process can be informed through that process of, hey, you know, especially in, and I come from collaborative delivery, in that process, one of the things is we don't chuck and run anymore. And we're looking at how we reorder decision-making in order to make a project flow. And this is the opportunity for the electrical to say to the GC, listen, in this process, this decision has to be made at the earliest convenience because it's going to be 52 weeks. So, hey, this is just what we know and what we have to do. And now we can order our decision-making processes to facilitate delivery on the field. That's, by the way, part of the way we get to design for manufacturing and assembly. The way we get to more efficient prefab, more efficient modular techniques, because we can make those decisions at the time they're supposed to be made. Mm-hmm. We can trust that they're going to happen. And a system and data can say, hey, listen, it's all ordered, right? It's on mm-hmm. order, and it's trackable, and it's measurable. And that can help us with the pay process and can help us with the sequencing process. Like, there's all sorts of things that this can really facilitate because it's the plumbing of what's going on.
Yeah, oh, completely. I mean, I've seen, you know, we've seen customers who use it as a way to help them bid on jobs, right? If there's a track record of saying, hey, this is, you know, this is our internal process, this is how often we've been able to deliver projects on time and on budget, you're creating increased confidence in your ability to say, hey, we actually have really best-in-class processes, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and that was, I mean, I learned this from one of my early customers, that in this market right now, reality is your strategic advantage. So if you can sit down and say, hey, look, I'm higher than everybody else you're talking to, but that's just because they're just trying to get to win the work. I'm telling you, it costs this much. It will cost this much in the end. Those people will hit you for change orders, or they'll get it some other way. I'm telling you, in reality, this is where it is, and this is the data that backs it up. And let's be more honest about it, because that is now your strategic advantage to say, listen, they're gonna tell you this, but honestly, in the end, you're going to pay that much. It's like going to buy tickets for a show and being like, oh, look, these are $20 tickets. I just paid $80 in fees. Awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And
I'd rather show up.
Breakdowns. Yeah, the line items start stacking up.
Exactly. And you're like, wait a minute. Your bid said it was this much. Oh, yeah, don't worry. We tacked on all this language to get you. And so it drives much more of a reality-based decision-making process for everybody, and owners then know what to budget and know what to come in on. So it's awesome. I think we could talk about this for days, Maria, but it's time to wrap up. But before I wrap it up, because you're focusing on these problems and the material escalation, what are some of the things you guys are focusing on moving forward that you think trade contractors and GCs should understand is probably coming their way?
A lot. I mean, we are spending, you know, $40 million on R&D in the next 3 years. So a lot. A couple of things that I'll bring up. One is, I think there are going to be significant increases in the capabilities of intelligence, right? So a lot of what we're building internally is, how do we make analytics even more powerful, right? How do we give you tracking capabilities that now, using AI, are capable, sort of possible, that weren't possible, let's say, a year or two ago? Number two is really, really focusing on every single type of PO, right? How do we make everything from large lot POs to rental POs? How do we make all of those more streamlined and easy to manage? It's doubling down on spend management, right? How do we stop you from spending that money in the first place? Not spending it and then tracking it later, but actually building in more permissioning, making it so it's easier for you to track rebates with different vendors that you have, to track payment schedules so that you know you're optimizing cash flow, and making it so that your orders are as accurate as possible so you're not spending the money that you shouldn't have actually spent. It's doubling down on things like tool tracking and inventory and prefab. you know, we've had, I'm going to say, hundreds of suggestions from various customers of ours for additional features that they want to see when it comes to tool tracking, or, you know, when it comes to their prefab capabilities. So those are all big areas for us to focus on. I think in general, for us, the way we think about it is it's going deep, right? It's taking features that aren't just at the surface level, but it's really making sure that if we talk about something like spend management, or if we talk about something like tool tracking, it's going to truly solve the problems that, you know, are most pertinent. And I think 2-3 years from now, you're going to look back on today and be like, wow, we were really just at the beginning.
Yep. I fully agree with you. And with the cost of money, cash flow, all the trade contractors I talk to, the cost of money is at the top of their minds. They're spending so much time because it costs so much now, and we're floating it. Trades especially are financing most of the jobs that exist.
Yeah, it takes a long time to get paid. I mean, you're really right. You're floating up a lot of cash as a trade contractor, and that's why you've got to know what you're spending on. And, you know, if you have receipts out there that are all coming in paper format and you're manually reconciling every single one of them, it's really hard to know, yeah, what that month close is actually going to look like, and whether you're going to hit your rebates, and whether you're going to hit all of the cashback opportunities that you have.
Yeah. Or just even get it all billed out to the customer correctly. Cause if it's not getting billed to somebody, you're eating it, and you know, you're eating it, and it's just eroding that margin in a way that you just can't see. And eventually the end of the year comes and you're like, wait a minute. You know, you just lost, you know, you invested all of this in productivity and you lost 1-2% on missed billing opportunities, missed cash flow mm-hmm. opportunities. And there it goes. All the productivity gains you got, you just lost because of a process that can be automated, a process that can be digital. And that's the power of like empowering the field with more. So I love it. Awesome time sitting down and talk to you. I'm surprised it's taken us this long, but I'm really psyched you got to sit down. We got to sit down and talk, Maria.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me, Jeff. This has been a lot of fun.
Well, I look forward to hopefully seeing you out there at one of those events this year. I'm back on the road as usual and back with my trade contractors. So hopefully I will see you out there on the road.
Absolutely. I look forward to it.
Welcome to the Construction Technology News of the Week. This week, I'm joined by Jacob Delbor. That's right. Jacob and I are sitting down to talk about news, talk about what's going on in the world. So welcome to the show. Welcome to the news, Jacob. How you doing, man?
Doing great, Jeff. Doing great. It's the last day of school for the kids. So school's out for summer. Here we go.
School's out for summer, baby. And as we're rolling into summer, we got some news. What you got for us?
Yeah, well, starting off, it's looking at the new well building standards. So this is a facilities dive article, and well was kind of come on the past about 3 years now. It's a standard that's not necessarily the same as LEED, but it's almost replacing LEED at this point. Well building standard actually requires healthy employee initiatives as well, not just healthy building initiatives. And then also it requires you to monitor, report back the actual, you know, eco-friendly stuff that you were doing. So they actually can track and say, oh, you actually did do this correctly, or you do need to adjust your building. Well, the article is just about hit 5 billion square foot milestone, which is, I would say, a pretty big thing for them. You know, they're still in the infancy, and that means they're expensive to do, right? You know, mm-hmm. doing new things is expensive. So I think this is where it kind of starts peaking and people will start being able to do it more cost effective. They have use cases, they have stuff. So I like the idea that we've hit these benchmarks. We're still going there. And then it just kind of gives you a little idea into what healthier buildings is and how this is more of a strategy versus a checkpoint. LEED is very much a, hey, you've hit your platinum status, check, here's your plaque. Thank you for the 80,000. So this is interesting. I'm actually really excited to see this more. It's a big conversation. And hey, if you're doing Class A office space right now, you better be getting well certified because it's one of the biggest attractions for employers.
I mean, it is, it's, it, the timing of it is kind of great, actually, to be honest. Like, you know, of course it's a facilities, you know, kind of approach from my boy Jacob, but this really, it's how are we measured? How are we going to impact the operations of a building? You know, but there was a time in which we needed LEED, and it looks like now we need more. We need to go beyond that standard and into the operations of the building, because we all know it's really about that. But I think the timing's interesting too, because we are seeing this shift to from remote work back to moving to the offices in a lot of major corporations. I think we've talked about this for a while. I think there's a sweet spot somewhere in all of this where there's a lot more openness to remote work. It's going to be depending on job type, depending on, you know, kind of what the company makeup is. But we are going to see, you know, a substantial amount of people back in offices of some sort. So to make sure that those have a new experience, have a better experience, are, you know, built better, operated better, and really pushing for wellness, you know. One of the problems with the commute is, you know, you're sitting in a car, then you're sitting at a desk, then you're sitting in a car. And it's not great for the health of the employee, and the health of the employee changes the sharpness of the brain. So this gives you guys on the BIM and VDC and into facilities management side a lot of stuff to work on.
Yep. And it definitely is an initiative that uses data, right? Like what we were talking about. This is data that is found, you know, that can be put into BIM models, that can be tracked, that can be done. So this is a really interesting use case for VDC and BIM as well. And then also it's being powered. I mean, basically, if there's an ESG goal, these well buildings really hit those ESG goals that they're going for. So hand in hand, you know, that they're both becoming more popular.
Yeah, it's awesome. The ESG is pushing how we're looking at real estate, how we're looking at the built environment. And it'd be cool too to see some modeling around how people interact in buildings and optimizing design and layout for that type of physical experience, moving around, having open spaces, but actually having closed spaces. You know, you remember those swings we've had over the years. Everybody's in an office, everybody's open. And it's like, I don't think everybody should be open. You know, any of you who actually accidentally answer a phone call from a telemarketing office with everybody in an open office, you hate it.
Yeah. Or if you've ever worked in the open office and you got the guy next to you that screams, and I might have been that guy next to you. So it's like, I have a loud voice. I'm sorry that it's an open office.
Yep. I used the company money back in the day, but bought everybody around me when we did that headphones. Cause yeah, yours truly is pretty loud as well. So we have that in common. What else you got for us, man?
All right. Next one up is construction dive. This is an interesting one. I actually really like this, by the idea of what a GC can do to manage their own risks. So Tudor Perini sees shift to owner financing on mega projects. And I'm actually going to even read the tagline here. The GC has been able to demand upfront payment on billion-dollar jobs as competition for large complex builds has waned, CEO Ron Tudor said on the first firm's first quarter earnings call. This is, you know, the fact is manage your risk. But B, you think about, we've talked on this show about paying your subs and your consultants and getting that upfront just so they can keep working. That this is, you know, their lifestyle. They don't have millions of dollars sitting in a bank that allows them to kind of go to work. The mental health aspect of this the idea that you guys can be sound and move forward. The other thing, if you want to be innovative in a project and you want to try new things, it takes money. It's easier to spend the money that you already have and can pay for than to hope that you can get it later. So I think that's an interesting thing. I think there's a mix of financing and conversation on it. They actually even seen increased profits and revenue, kind of course, you're not wasting overhead trying to track down 90-day invoices, but it really is. Coming from this industry, even being somebody that's on the owner's side all the time.
I think this is really great. I mean, we really have to see with the size of these mega projects and with the amount of risk and the amount of money, you're absolutely on to it, Jacob. We need to see the either early pay by the owners, or I believe, you know, and I've talked to a couple folks about this along the way, mainly Pete Dumont, is we really have to look at changing the finance model around mega projects, because it's actually creating more cost for the owners, you know, to have those 90 days pay cycles, to have our trade contractors and even material suppliers kind of financing these jobs is driving up the cost overall. So there's an opportunity to save money. You know, I wouldn't say it would make the projects cheaper. It will just slow the growth of the cost. But no. To your point, this is an opportunity too to innovate, where owners can get in and pre-purchase materials and finance that part, because look, they're way better modeled for this. You know, that's what owners are modeled for. Construction companies aren't modeled to be that type of a financial institution. And there's a ton of opportunity, unless you do something like what Pete's talking about. And if you guys haven't seen what Pete talks about out there, go check out Pete Dumont, but he talks about really changing this to give everybody a piece of the pie in the project itself. And again, it's really about just flipping the financial model. So it's really cool to see Tudor Perini leading this, because we're seeing some there's some problems happening in some of these mega projects, and to some of the GCs, et cetera, that are getting involved. That's why I think you're seeing the appetite wane. You know, they're mostly JV projects and it's tough.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think there is any of these mega projects out there that probably aren't JV. Mm-hmm. Just because you got to be able to tag the risk together. You can't put that all on one company. And, you know, it's going to be good. I think what Peter's talking about is everybody gets a piece of the pie. You want motivation? That's going to give you the motivation, right? You know that you can earn more by doing it correctly, then let's do it correctly. The other thing too is, you know, pre-con is such a crap phase for GCs. It's, you got to invest a lot of money. You don't have really that much payment. And that if you had this upfront, the amount of planning and work you can do in a pre-con phase just gets so much better. And you can actually really plan out a project.
Yeah, if you can turn it from free con to an opportunity to advance the delivery of the project itself and have that part funded. I think more and more we're going to see that as less of a cost center and more of a strategic advantage and something you pay for. You know, yep. It's kind of like a consultant. And, you know, also if they can release more of that money, the GCs in the pre-construction phase can release more of the money to the trade contractors, bring them to the table earlier. We can start seeing bigger, more powerful prefabricated environments with, you know, multi-chain racking and pods, and, you know, also fund them through that innovation cycle, which is really important to get that innovation cycle.
Yeah. I mean, when you're not working at risk, you're willing to take more risk.
Exactly. Yeah. When you're sharing that risk, even, you know, yeah, like, hey, exactly. you're in on the materials, we're in on the labor. Okay. I can take that split for a while, especially in pre-construction and getting ready for prefab. It's a way to balance that cost and really share the risk. And, you know, we'll go to a Nathan Wood, shared risk, shared reward. That's what we got to do. Well, I'm going to jump because I love this, because to me, I wanted to talk about, you know, we're going into the summer here, and I don't know about you, but I'm seeing construction everywhere I go. And the largest commercial construction starts of April 2024. We didn't plan this, guys. I promise you. It just fell in line this way. This is what I brought to the table. And it really follows the Tudor Perini article really, really well, because if you look, the rebounds and starts in April was certainly good news for the sector. You know, there's still some uncertain timing on the Fed interest rate cuts or if they even happen. You know, depends on who you listen to. But just listen to these 9 projects. A $3.7 billion UC Davis Medical Center in Sacramento, $1.8 billion Lindy Blue hydrogen plant in Beaumont, Texas, $1 billion Scout Motors electric vehicle plant in Blythewood, South Carolina, $834 million on I-405 brickyard improvement. I mean, this just keeps going down the line. And I mean, the one I want to go is, you know, if anybody needs somebody on site consulting on technology in the $490 million resurfacing project in Lanai City, Hawaii, I know a guy who's available. So, I mean, just think about comparing those start project, you know, estimations versus what we used to do and what we used to see, Jacob.
It's incredible. It's we have entered a new age. The tax acts, the energy acts, it's propelled mega projects, and it's good. I want to keep it going. I love seeing this. I love seeing it from stuff like UC Davis, because we need better healthcare, we need better stuff. But man, this is a lot of money, and it's a matter of who's doing it. We're going to be getting there still. I mean, I think the crazy thing about this article to and wrap your head around is the fact that this is only April. These are the projects that started in April. And like, this has become a common theme. It's these billion with a B is becoming very common as a construction budget. And that blows my mind for some reason, but it's good. I think we're really able to, I mean, it makes sense because they're actually willing to pay for the higher prices. They're willing to pay for better labor. They're, you know, it's driving costs up, but it looks like owners are still willing to pay.
Yeah, I think there's a lot around the incentives that you're right about. A little bit of interesting on sector performance at the bottom. Obviously, residential is still down a little bit, but and single family as well. But the interesting part is multifamily increased by 13%. And to me, that's a sign that those commercial builders really do think the Fed cut is coming, because they're the ones who risk the most in that area. And I think that's a good sign for us overall. So you're right, man, but it's great to see the money coming in between the IIJA, some of the other things we've got. It's just going to keep going up. And I think in a year or two, you and I'll just be like, oh yeah, it's just another $1 billion project. You know, it'll be $10 billion when we're like, oh yeah, now we're impressed. You know?
Man, there were four $10 billion projects that started this month.
Yeah, I don't think we'll see the $100 billion, but you know, who knows, man? In our lifetime, you never know what's going to happen.
Never know.
Well, my last one's kind of interesting because this, you know, we can't have a news without AI, but this is a little shout to my good friend Katie Zappieri. She jumped on, and you know, she's in marketing. She's the brains behind a lot of the construction tech startups you have. I got to meet her years ago. I've been working with her for a long time. Really great mind in, you know, in healthily, you know, in a really good way, marketing to our sector and really understanding what goes on in our sector and understanding how to speak to them in a voice that, you know, works. And she's talking about Google changed their algorithm. Here's what this means for creators and brands. So Google's latest algorithm update deprioritizes AI generated content. So just a little thing, they're using AI to deprioritize AI, which I think is interesting. But what it's really doing is saying, listen, we can use this to powerfully make sure that what you're getting is still valuable information. It's not just, and so people know, a lot of folks, when they found this AI thing, they went out and they started generating all the blogs that most of you love to read, and they're not new. They're just AI generated. They're just out there for SEO. They're just out there to drive people to the site. And they're pretty much worthless in many cases, you know, because they're regurgitation of other things. So Google's gone ahead and got ahead of it and, you know, is deprioritizing that, which really allows those of us in the space where, you know, that's what I do a lot of, is speaking to customers, speaking to the market, being in the media side of things, is focus on quality, stay authentic, and engage more. And those are all the things that we value on our side in construction tech. So it's cool to see this.
Yeah, this is cool. You know, and it's interesting.
Google has gotten so messy, and it's because of this. But I mean, literally anything you Google now has some type of blog type to it. And it's really funny because I mean, you can go and Google like how to remove your foot from a door. And there's all of a sudden there's a blog post that has like steps and works and it like lays it out for you. And you're like, where did that come from? But you can tell it's completely AI generated. Like, I almost feel like that they just wait for the Google search to come through and that automatically makes it for me. But this is good. My question is stay authentic, stay, you know, focus on quality. I run just about everything I do through some type of AI now, just so, cause it makes it sound better. It makes it, you know, really kind of get the point across. Is that going to notice the same things? Probably not, because I start somewhere else than just a blank slate and ask AI to do it. But I would hope not, because that would, you know, start hurting me, and my authenticity is still ran through ChatGPT.
No, so that is the interesting part about if you dig in, and so I wanted Katie to get the, you know, the credit for it, because that's what got me down the rabbit hole. But the idea is it can tell if you've used it to help you with your voice, with your grammar, something we've done for years with ghostwriters. I mean, a lot of the blog content, a lot of the things you see out there are written by ghostwriters. And that's not to say it's not the voice of the person that they're writing for. That's it. It's a process of getting that person to understand your voice, understand your ideas, your original content, what you care about and what you think your clients care about or the market cares about or the industry cares about. And then you use it to sound good. Because look, without Grammarly, man, I don't think anybody would really listen to me because they couldn't read what I was writing because it would be so poorly done. And so I'd have grammar cops after me all the time. So I think this is a progression of that where the AI can understand what was started from original thought and then amplified and helped to the creation point through AI versus vice versa. Yep. Generate me a bunch of crap to bring people SEO-wise to my site. However, look, we did say this, and it's been out there. There will be, in fact, more genuinely real content out there thanks to AI because it gives people the power to write better.
Yes.
And more focused and get through their thoughts. So it's going to be an interesting world. I mean, the beauty is, you can use AI to read your news now too. So won't it be great when it's like, yeah, this is AI generated. You don't want, you don't need this.
Right.
You know, let's go on. Oh, this is a really unique thought and, you know, boil it down. This is what Jacob's talking about. If you want to dive in further, you dive in further. So, you know, this is where I think AI, instead of killing humanity, will actually amplify and give us better access to real thought and real content in a way that we want to integrate or interface with it.
Yep. I think this is great. And for all those people out there thinking that I've been like, just, I'm so proper and everything I write, it's Grammarly. I'm sorry. Burst your bubble.
I hate to burst your bubble, guys, but it's Grammarly. But it's not bursting their bubbles because, you know, especially to my grammar cop friends out there, they really appreciate it.
Yep.
Well, Jacob, thanks for sitting down for the construction technology news of the week this week. I really appreciate having you.
Absolutely, Jeff. Have a great weekend.
And thank you for tuning in today to geek out for our interview with Maria Davidson. To read all our news stories, learn about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontechcrew.com. This is the Contech Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.